I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the gravitational pull of violence for kids in Chicago. But first, President Obama is meeting with congressional leaders today ahead of his speech on Afghanistan tonight. Among those meeting with the president, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, who's signaled his support for the plan to send 30,000 additional troops to the war. And that may be key in rallying wavering Democrats. Kerry chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The president needs him on board when hearings begin this week. But historian Julian Zelitzer says no matter who's on board, tonight's speech could mark a turning point, one that might change the way Obama is viewed by history. Julian is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, finish that thought. How may Obama be viewed as a result of what he says tonight?
Well, it's very simple. War can start to consume the presidency, and this could become much more important than his domestic issues in the coming year. So he could join the long list of wartime presidents who we've had in the past half century.
In fact, you put that list together on CNN.com. We'll link listeners to your essay at our website, hereandnow.org. But you say war sucks the political oxygen out of almost any presidency. So give us the examples.
Well, the most famous example is Harry Truman, who starts in 1948 and 49 after being reelected with a very ambitious domestic vision, the fair deal, health care, civil rights. But in the end, Korea really becomes the defining aspect of his presidency and brings down the Democrats in 1952. Lyndon Johnson is on the verge of being a transformative president in 1965, passing much more legislation than most presidents. Health care, civil rights, voting rights, immigration reform, and in the end it will be Vietnam that not only brings down his presidency, but is how we remember who he was and what he was about.
Well, let's take them one at a time. You mentioned Truman, followed by General Dwight Eisenhower, who accused Truman of being too trusting, soft, and weak, and of course, speaking of the communists, and saying that if he had been tougher, there might not have been a war in Korea. But when Eisenhower did become president, the Korean War was waging. He was a general. Do we think of him as a war president?
Well, he brings the war to an end. I mean, he settles on an agreement very early in his presidency. I think what followed was much more important, both his popularity, Eisenhower's popularity, the economic prosperity of the decade, and the rest of the Cold War. So he actually ends it pretty quickly, and it's not really identified as Eisenhower's war.
And then to Johnson again in Vietnam. Johnson, of course, followed by Nixon. Many people think of Vietnam is Nixon's war. But you have a quote from Johnson. How did he speak of the war?
In his memoirs, he told his biographer that that bitch of a war killed the lady I really loved, the Great Society. And he was very cognizant of the fact that many of his achievements early on were ultimately swamped by this war, both politically, budgetarily, and again, in historical memory.
He did, as you say, Americanize the war in that he raised the number of troops who were there as opposed to the American advisors who were there. But that conflict had been going on for a while before Johnson. So what do you say to those who say he had to do something?
He didn't have to do something. I mean, one of the most remarkable aspects of 1964 and early 1965 is how many people are telling Lyndon Johnson, don't do this. Not liberal college protesters, but mainstream conservative Democrats. Richard Russell, for example, from Georgia, is privately telling the president on the phone, if we go into this war, we'll never win. George Smathers, a Florida conservative Democrat, tells the president he's been on Capitol Hill and he can't find a single person who supports this war. And Lyndon Johnson knew this as well. It was not inevitable to go where we ended up.
Well, that brings us back to present time. President George W. Bush, of course, is a war president.
President Bush was defined by Iraq, and many of his other accomplishments that some support and some don't, whether you're talking about No Child Left Behind or even the domestic part of the war on terrorism, the reconstruction of our homeland security, those were drowned out, I would argue, politically by Iraq. And the irony is here is a candidate, Barack Obama, when he was a candidate, who defined himself through his opposition to Iraq, now is not only inheriting another war, but expanding that war.
Do you think, as many commentators are saying today, that After tonight, Barack Obama owns the war.
I do think now it will be seen as President Obama's war, whatever happens. I think people are going to no longer think of this as just a post-9/11 war, a George Bush war. But I think what happens now is on Obama's time, and it's on his political reputation.
Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, reminding us of presidents past who've had to tackle war. His new book, by the way, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, is being published this month. Julian, I can't wait to talk to you about that. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
The cell phone video of the September beating death of 16-year-old Darion Albert in an after-school brawl brought international attention to the problem of violence in Chicago. Last year, 36 Chicago school students were murdered, a record high, and more than 200 were wounded by gunfire, most as they walked to and from school. So today we want to speak with a Chicago parent and a Catholic priest, Father David Kelly, who works with kids, including our first guest. Donzel Mintz is a 17-year-old junior who actually goes to a special school, the Second Chance High School. It's located in Father Kelly's center. Donzel is a ward of the state. He spent 2 years in jail for petty crimes, but also because as a foster child, there was nowhere for him to go. And now he's been trying to go straight. He's one of the ones Father Kelly thinks might make it. So we scheduled a conversation, and in the interim, Donzel was beaten up. Donzel, first of all, how are you?
Good.
Well, what happened?
I was just hanging with my friends and stuff. Then, like, an argument started. I wasn't really, like, trying to fight, but I felt like I'm going to have to defend myself if something happened.
What was the fight over?
It was just me arguing, telling them that I ain't going to be, talked to that way type stuff.
Oh, so somebody was maybe using language with you didn't like?
Yeah.
Was it a pride thing?
Yes, that's what it was really all about, pride. That's the whole reason why people be fighting for, because they don't want to feel like they being punked.
Somebody was feeling punked and put down, and it just escalated. It just grew from there?
Yes, because there was, like, a whole bunch of people around, like, other boys, girls. So, like, they watching everything that's going on, so people don't want to, like, look like they are punk in front of them.
Well, but here you are. I mean, you've been talking about this with Father Kelly, who we're going to speak to, and other people. You know, was there a part of your brain that said, wait a minute, Donzel, this is what I've been learning, you know, to walk away? Did you think of doing that, or is it too late? Does it just feel like you have to act a certain way?
Yeah, like, I felt like I was being, like, punked, too. But, like, the people that I was arguing with was my ride home.
Oh.
So I was like, I just wait till all this cooled down, then I see, can I still get my ride home? But everything kept on escalating, and I ended up getting jumped, and I had to call Father Kelly for a ride home.
You had to call Father Kelly. Well, thank goodness he came. But so I can understand. It's sort of like, well, gee, if I walk away from this, I walk away from my ride. We know how dangerous it is to walk the streets without a car. So we understand you got yourself a big black eye.
Yeah. No, I just got hit in the face with a bottle.
Oh. Listen, you have told us that you have serious concerns about just staying alive. What were you thinking when suddenly there you are with a bottle to your face? I mean,
I was saying, at least I ain't dead. I was, like, thinking, like, this said, like, thinking of, like, all the other people that died, like Darion, thinking about him.
Darion Albert, you were. Hmm.
I was like, I couldn't really breathe that good. That's why I was like, this probably it, getting kicked and stuff.
When you were stomped?
Yeah. I was just real sad, though, because right before I got hit with the bottle, my friend, he was talking to me. He was crying. It was like an emotional moment, like, what was going on?
Why was he crying?
Because we was all, like, we supposed to have been all friends. So that's why he was crying, like, what's going on? So while I was talking to him, the other boy ran up and hit me in the face with a bottle.
It sounds like nobody wants it to happen, but it happens anyway.
Yeah.
Do you learn anything from this, Donzel? What do you think you've learned?
Like, some places, it's like you just ain't wanted. People don't really want you there. Like, I stay to myself now.
But you've been telling us that this is something that you are doing anyway. These are sort of some of your survival techniques, even at school. Tell us what else you do to try to keep yourself from being a target. Like, how do you dress?
In school uniform, walk fast until my destination, catch the bus.
Walk fast. Yeah. So no gang colors?
No. Don't say nothing to nobody while I'm walking. Like, somebody asks me for something, it's like, no. Don't try to, like, go somewhere new all by yourself. Take somebody with you or, like, have a cell phone.
Yeah. And we understand that in the past, one of your role models was a probation officer. In fact, is that what you hope to be someday?
Yes, a youth probation officer.
And how will you try to help kids like yourself?
Ask them what's going on. I feel like if I catch somebody that's just like me, I went through the same thing. Here's my card. So if something just pop up and you think I can help you with it, just call me. Everybody in the center, I got a card. Now I got my cell phone. I just put all their numbers in my cell phone. Like, luckily, I had Father Kelly number that night. Because that was, like, the only people I was able to go to.
Well, Dunzel, thanks so much for talking to us, and we really wish you well.
Okay.
17-year-old Dunzel Mintz trying to stay out of trouble in Chicago. And as we heard, he turned to Father Kelly for help. Father Kelly helped found the Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation Center that's just above Dunzel's school. So we turn to Father Kelly now. Father Kelly, here's one of the good kids trying not to become a target, and he gets beaten up. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it is frustrating. You get angry both at kids who, even the good kids who put themselves in situations where potentially they could be harmed. Many of the kids, you know, walk around with this, I don't want to call it rage, but kind of an ever-present kind of anger that can be set off with the smallest things. I mean, how many kids have I heard say, well, he looked at me wrong?
And we don't have to be professionals to understand that these kids, in many cases, probably just don't have a good sense of themselves. And so they're perfectly ready to feel that someone's trying to shame them.
Right. And they grow up in situations of violence. Oftentimes, there's violence in the home. And it's not that their parent or mother doesn't love them. It's just oftentimes she has her own issues that she's going through and doesn't give the kid the kind of time a child growing up needs. So kids grow up feeling neglected, that they're not worthwhile. I've heard kids in juvenile detention center talk to me about, if my mother won't even come to visit me, then who am I? I must be a horrible person. So they have this damaged self-image that they walk around with, and oftentimes use drugs or alcohol, I believe, to allow themselves a little bit of peace from the turmoil that they feel within themselves. And I think violence also is a way to feel in control of myself, even though really it's being out of control.
But, well, as we just heard,
lash out at someone else makes me feel in control.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Father David Kelly, who counsels at-risk kids in Chicago. Chicago is providing more buses to give kids safe passage to and from school. A new $60 million program targets about 10,000 high-risk kids. They'll be kept anonymous, but given advocates on call 24 hours a day, after-school jobs. But some mothers have gotten together. They say, let's talk to the kids. We'll hear from one after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the violence that school kids in Chicago face as they walk to and from school in gang-dominated neighborhoods. Darion Albert was beaten to death in September in a brawl caught on video. A few weeks later, 17-year-old Gamiel Toscano was shot and killed. And his mom was, and still is, a member of a group called Mothers for Peace. As is our next guest, Lisa Rivera. Her middle son has been in and out of trouble for gang-affiliated petty crimes. She joined Mothers for Peace, which formed about 2 years ago, moms hoping to reach out directly to at-risk teens. This year, the group held its first Thanksgiving dinners to bring kids and moms together. Lisa Rivera, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Lisa, it sounds like you're the exact opposite of adults who may have let kids down. In fact, you call yourself an overachieving parent, a married mother of three. You work in a law firm and live in the same neighborhoods that mayors and police officers come from in Chicago.
True.
And yet you still had to go to what sound like terrific lengths to try to protect, particularly one of your three sons. What did you do to try to keep him safe?
Well, first of all, I had to get past, you know, the shame, embarrassment, humiliation of the situation, because I had been very active in the community, and I almost thought that people would look and say, you know, what a hypocrite. But you never know what they're doing and what they're like outside of the home.
Right.
My son was a great person inside the home. I mean, he very respectful, never even to this day cussed in front of me. But, you know, I would see him hanging out on a particular street, and I would just like, okay, that's unusual, because he never did that.
But then there was a point when you realized there was a problem.
Oh, yeah, and then we started, you know, with the whole confrontations and the, you know, fighting in the street, because when I would pull up and I would see him somewhere that I didn't think he should be, he had 2 seconds to get in the car, or else I was standing out there with him. He always had a choice.
Right, but one was embarrassing to have your mother standing with you, and yet you did this. You did all of this time,
all the time. You know, every single night. I mean, even when he had gotten in trouble and he was home on, you know, a curfew situation, he would never be at the house when he was supposed to. So, you know, my husband went out the door to the left, and I went out the door to the right, and here we are now hunting down this kid.
Right.
It was a constant. He put the family through so much because, you know, when you're on that curfew situation, they come all hours of the night to check and make sure that he's where he's supposed to be. So none of us slept. He was the only one that was having a good time.
And he was under a curfew because?
He was out on bond, and he had to deal with, you know, some charges. And while he was waiting for trial, this is something that we all had to deal with, you know. But we loved him, and we wanted to support him. But he was making it very difficult for us to continue to do those things.
So along comes Mothers for Peace, which does what for you at this point?
Well, I think that if it were not for Mothers for Peace, I would be making the same mistakes that I did with my youngest son.
In other words, we've been talking about your middle son. The oldest son is the one who got out before these bad apples.
Right. Everything. I led by example, and yet they're two different kids with the same mother. You know,
So the middle son had the problems, and you were afraid that you might, whatever you did wrong as a parent, you didn't want to do wrong again for the youngest son, including what? What do they help you understand?
Well, I knew that I loved him, and I knew that I had to stop this negative momentum, but I didn't know how. My way was the way that I was raised, by trying to guilt somebody or shame somebody into acting a certain way. Mm-hmm. Even my husband, when they were younger, he'd say, you want them to look like tin soldiers. Like, you know, you were supposed to act this way, be this way, that was it. Well, not everybody can fill that mold. You know, he was more of the social one, and he wanted to be out there with friends and went to parties, whereas my oldest one was not like that. I mean, I was just taking from what I knew. And with my middle son, it just became, it enraged me so much, you know, because everything first was so personal. Like, I don't deserve this. How could you, you know, I worked so hard to be this way with you and, you know, did everything for you. And I had to get past that whole me thing. But in the process, I was criticizing him and judging him and, you know, not just him, the friends, the way he would dress, his hair. You know, and it just, I realize now that I made it so uncomfortable for him to be in his own home that I basically pushed him to the corner where his friends were waiting with open arms. When I would go and hunt him down, like my husband used to refer to it, I did it in anger. I was jumping out of that car and get in here. And I could have just pulled him over to the side and said, you know, I really don't want to see you here. This is not for you. You know, make your way home. I'll be there in a few minutes.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned some things from the moms in the group. They've maybe learned some things from me. Motherhood is such a sisterhood. It's a powerful thing.
That sounds very hopeful. But on another level, it feels hopeless. And I'm referring to the story of Gamaliel Toscano. Again, he was the young man who was gunned down. His mother was an active member of this group. So here we are again, a parent paying attention, reaching out to other parents to see what she can do. When that happened, you know, someone in the group, what were your thoughts?
Well, I was very sad, of course, for her because it's a tragic loss. But I was also sad for another reason, because I knew that automatically her morals and her values were going to be put on trial way before the perpetrator's first day in court. And, you know, when I guess one of the reporters had asked her the question, you know, do you have anything that you would like to say to the person who killed Gama? And she said, I forgive him. And that is exactly what we do in the group. We learn our own conflict resolution. We practice it so that our kids will follow.
Lisa Rivera, a founding member of the Mothers for Peace group in South Chicago. Thank you so much.
Take care.
And best of luck to all those moms. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have reaction to President Obama's speech on Afghanistan from a military analyst against the planned surge and a veteran of the war who says 30,000 troops isn't enough. Also, a GPS hunt for a bright red weather balloon. If you find it, $40,000 is yours. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Alex Rider rides again as the teenage spy for British intelligence. We'll hear from the popular series author Anthony Horowitz. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. There's been a big sports upset. I'm not talking about our New England Patriots and their disastrous loss to the New Orleans Saints last night. I'm talking high school ball. It took 6 years and 79 football games, but one of the longest winning streaks in high school football has come to an end. The Smith Center High School team faced something none of the players had previously experienced ever this weekend, defeat. They lost to Centralia High School, which beat them 20-12 and took the title of Kansas State champions, the first school other than Smith to have that title for almost a decade. In a town where 70% of high school boys play football and the kids' coach was also their parents' coach, have they learned how to handle defeat? Well, you might remember New York Times sports writer Joe Drape moved to Smith Center in Kansas to write the book Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. After he first reported on the team for the New York Times, he told us about the team in September, and he joins us again today to tell us about their loss. Joe, how'd they take it?
You know, Robin, they took it like I had hoped they would. They took it with class and a lot of heartbreak and a lot of tears. But it really was an epic game. It went in overtime. It finished on the last play. And as soon as the young man fumbled and Centralia came up with the ball, the Smith Center people, and there was about 3,000 there, gave a standing ovation to both teams. And you know, I didn't want to see them lose. They didn't want to lose. It was heartbreaking for the seniors to lose. But I was sort of gratified that this is how I thought they'd act, and that's exactly what happened. They got down to the field. They hugged their kids. You know, later in the locker room, Coach Roger Barta said, nobody hang their head in here. We've lined up 80 times against teams. One of them finally got us on the last play in a game that's going to go down in the history books. And we don't measure ourselves by wins or loss anyway. We measure ourselves about being there for each other. And you guys and the six classes before you have all been there. And the sun's going to come up. So, you know, they went out epically. And if you got to go out on the last play of a championship game in overtime, that's the way to go.
Well, and you've told us a lot about this coach, Roger Barta. It's really astonishing to read in your book how his whole game plan is getting kids to care about each other. I mean, that seems where it all starts. And, you know, you lived in the town, you met the boys, and they told you it was tough at first sometimes for them to gel that way, but they finally understood that was what winning meant, caring about each other.
Absolutely, Robin. You know, it's love, patience, and hard work, and at least for the football team, it was a four-year process. I mean, it took until you got to be a senior to understand everything he was teaching you, he was telling you, that he was hoping you'd embrace and using the exercises to make it happen. You know, the light never clicked in these guys until they were seniors, until it was almost over, to understand really how special a ride it had been. And, you know, that's life. Any of us who have 14 to 18-year-olds, in anything, that's how you raise kids, right. And that's how you try to. I mean, they don't get it on the first time.
Well, I should say we need to give some props to Centralia High School. Congratulate them. They obviously earned
absolutely,
that game.
Absolutely, Robin. You know, tip of the hat. They played hard, well. They team, and you know they showed mutual respect, and they just beat them, and that's what coach and everybody said. They
just beat them. Well, 79 games though, 70. It's almost unimaginable. I know to particularly one nephew, it's unimaginable. 79 games in a winning streak. You describe after the coach's speech, a senior, the captain, steps forward, offers a prayer. His dad played for the same coach. There was a lot of pressure on him. So just in the few seconds we have, a lot of pain, a lot of sadness, but maybe a little bit of relief, too. It had finally happened. Yeah.
You know, in fact, one of the mothers said to me, we can kind of breathe right now. Nobody wanted to see this senior class go out. The tears were just of empathy. So, you know, everybody's going to live to play another day, and that's what high school football should be about.
Joe Drape, sports writer for the New York Times, author of Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmond. Great Christmas gift for young people. And he's talking about the Smith Center team finally having a loss after a 79-game winning streak, losing to Centralia High School there in Kansas. Joe, thanks as always for bringing us the story.
Robin, take care.
Back in 30 seconds, here and now. The white sandy beaches of Florida's panhandle are ground zero for the latest property rights battle before the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that pits six beachfront property owners against the state. In 2007, Florida poured sand onto miles of beach along the Gulf of Mexico to restore the beach after storms. The state then claimed that the extra beach it had created was now public. The property owners sued, saying the state should either compensate them or restore their property rights back to the waterline. Well, the Florida Supreme Court sided with the state. The homeowners were not compensated, and tomorrow the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments. Now, you might remember the Supreme Court's last major property case back in 2005. It ruled that New London, Connecticut, could seize dozens of homes as part of an urban development scheme designed to lure the Pfizer drug company to the area. The justices ruled in favor of the city, which caused an uproar across the country. Then the city knocked down the homes and, it turns out, never developed the property. And last month, Pfizer announced it was leaving town, making matters worse for critics. So how might negative fallout from all of this affect this new Florida case? Michael Allen Wolf is a professor at the University of Florida Levin College. He joins us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And we know you're there in Gainesville, Florida, about 6 hours southeast of Destin, where this whole beach restoration story began. Give us a sense of what exactly is happening there with the erosion and what the state felt they had to do.
As you know, the panhandle of Florida is prone to tropical storms and hurricanes. And back in 1995, there was a hurricane Opal, and it caused severe damage on the beach erosion, which giant storms have a tendency to do. And in fact, in the years since then, there have been two hurricanes and another tropical storm that have hit the Destin-Walton County area pretty severely. So one response the state has is to renourish the beaches. Certain landowners complained about the fact that their property lines no longer touch the water that led to this lawsuit.
Well, they're saying that, in fact, by doing this, the state took away their homeowner property rights. One told us, Patricia Young, told us she feels that people don't understand that they're losing a valuable asset in all of this. But more important, they think it's violating existing law. So tell us more about what they're arguing.
Their argument in the Florida Supreme Court was that the state had no right to claim ownership of the beach that was restored, that they were beachfront owners before the storm. They should be beachfront owners after the storm. And that's a simple argument. Unfortunately for them, the Florida Supreme Court rejected that argument. And in the course of rejecting that argument, it's claimed that the Florida Supreme Court changed property law. And in doing so, the allegation is that when they changed the law, the justices, not the state legislature, the justices on the state Supreme Court actually took the property of these landowners. That's a dramatically new argument the Supreme Court has never really considered.
Huh. So let's just to be clear. So these homeowners are not as much now saying that the state violated their rights. They're saying that the state courts violated their rights.
That's correct. The state Supreme Court, the same court that decided Bush v. Gore, the same state Supreme Court that decided that case, when they rendered a decision in this case, the allegation is that those justices in the majority took the property rights of these landowners. That is new. That is potentially devastating for the courts.
There is some speculation that there was such outrage at their ruling in New London in favor of the city to seize property to kind of lure a company in. And there was such outrage then that some are saying that maybe the justices will do what you call a make good tomorrow.
Yeah, like a makeup call in sports. And I think maybe some of the justices think they'd like to hear another private property rights case to get it right this time, much like an official in a sports match, let's say a football game. An official makes a call against the home team and everybody starts to booze and they show it on replay and it looks like the official made the wrong call. The next opportunity, the umpire or the referee is going to try to make a call against the opposing team to get it right, to make up for the mistake. And it doesn't work well in sports, and it certainly doesn't work well with the law.
Well, let's just speculate, though. If, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court rules for the homeowners and says that the state has no right to make this new sandy beach a public beach, what could be the fallout of that?
If the Supreme Court should adopt this theory, it could have what we call a chilling effect on state justices, on state Supreme Courts. And in the area of beach erosion, this is a very important area. We have rising seas, global warming, super intensive storms, and sometimes those new realities have to be met by changes in judge-made common law. And judges are going to be afraid to do so because they're going to be afraid that the state is going to have to foot the bill.
But just a quick question. Couldn't Florida still address its beach erosion, still bring in sand, and just leave it private property?
They could, but who's going to foot the bill? The taxpayers foot the bill. This is a gigantic bill. And by the way, it wasn't all the landowners who were complaining. Most of the landowners who benefited from this beach renourishment program did not complain. These landowners are making, in a constitutional sense, they're making a very narrow argument that they have a constitutionally protected right to physical contact with the water. No one is going to prevent these landowners from viewing the beach. No one's going to prevent them from going on to the beach. They're going to have many of the rights they had before, but their right to contact the water, that's what they claim has been taken away.
And plus, many people are happy to see, you know, more tourists able to come to the area. So there's that economic issue as well, even though the homeowners say they're worried there's going to be vendors and all sorts of things in their front door.
But the law says that they cannot block their access. That is, the state cannot block the landowner's access to the water or the view, or their view of the water.
And by the way, we should say that laws about access to water vary from state to state. We're just talking about Florida in this case.
Right, right.
That's Michael Allen Wolf, a professor at the University of Florida Levin College of Law, speaking about a Supreme Court case that will be taken up tomorrow, determining whether a seven-mile stretch of Florida beach is private or public and all the ramifications that will come from that decision. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Here and Now. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof once put the books of Anthony Horowitz on his list of best kids' books ever. Well, students packed into an auditorium at the Wellesley Middle School here in Wellesley, Massachusetts, would concur.
And without further introduction, it's my privilege to introduce to you Mr. Anthony Horowitz.
Anthony Horowitz is the author of the Alex Rider books, which have sold 12 million copies in his native Britain and over 5 million in the U.S. The hero, Alex, is a spy recruited by MI6, the British Secret Service. He infiltrates evil organizations and faces deadly peril almost on a daily basis. Take this scene where Alex is jumping from a speeding Jeep to a plane, taking off on a runway.
Alex let go of the steering wheel, grabbed the harpoon gun, and fired. The harpoon flashed through the air. The yo-yo attached to Alex's belt spun, trailing out 30 yards of specially designed advanced nylon cord. The pointed head of the harpoon buried itself in the underbelly of the plane. Alex felt himself almost being torn in half as he was yanked out of the Jeep and onto the end of the cord. In seconds, he was 40, 50 yards above the runway, dangling underneath the plane.
Well, the yo-yo is a clue. Super spy Alex Rider is only 14. Think James Bond in sneakers. And the yo-yo, that isn't what it seems, is just one of the high-tech gadgets he uses to get out of trouble, though mostly Alex has to rely on his wits, and the Wellesley kids love him.
They really relate to kids my age. Alex Rider's a lot like the average American boy, but then he's English and he's a spy.
He's a smart kid, knows how to, like, make the best out of, like, the situation.
I think it's, like, every kid's dream to be a spy, and so reading someone living your dream is pretty cool. It's like if Alex was real, you'd kind of want him to be your friend.
I love this series. It's like my favorite series, like, ever. This is the only one with all the action, all the gadgets and stuff. It's just everything I like.
Here now's Emiko Tamagawa met up with Anthony Horowitz as he signed stacks of the latest Alex Rider installment, Crocodile Tears. She asked him how the series began.
I remembered suddenly about 10 years ago an idea I'd had for a long time, which was to do basically a James Bond-style book, but with a teenager in the lead. And this was inspired by the fact that, in my view, Bond had got too old, particularly when he was played by Roger Moore. Then I wrote that first sentence, "When the doorbell rings at 3 a.m, it's never good news." And I have to say that as soon as that was on the page, I knew I'd cracked it. I knew that something special was going to happen with this book. That was the beginning.
And like James Bond, Alex has gadgets.
I wasn't going to put gadgets into the Alex Rider books because one of the most important things for me is that they should be original. But there's a thin line between borrowing from or paying homage to James Bond and simply ripping him off. But the kids who I spoke to in schools were so hung up on gadgets that in the end I had to change my mind. And I created Smithers, who is my gadget master, who is as different to Q in the Bond films as it is possible to be. And I have two rules for the gadgets in the Alex Rider books. The first is that they should be something you would find in a teenager's bedroom or in his pockets, so they've got to be something that a schoolboy would have with him. And the second thing is they've got to be non-lethal. I don't have much killing in the books. Well, people die, but not in too violent and too obvious a way.
You're right, there's not excessive violence, and Alex himself doesn't want to kill, but people do die as a result of his actions.
A writer like me has to tread a fine line. I'm very aware that I owe a great deal of my success to the teachers and to the parents and to the librarians who allow these books to reach young people. And to them I have a responsibility not to go for gross-out violence, not to use bad language. At the same time, though, I am writing for an audience that does like action and it does like, you know, an edge to the books, danger. And you cannot have danger without a threat of death, and you cannot have a threat of death without actual death. So yes, Alex does inhabit a violent world, but it is a violent world that has no connectivity, I think, with the real world. I mean, it's his own world, and that's why I think the books work, that I can go so far, and yes, one can have some fairly spectacular deaths in the books, but they're ones that always come somehow with a smile and a knowledge that they're not actually real.
The thing about Alex, though, is, you know, the kids were talking about it's fast-paced, it's energetic, that, you know, they love how inventive he is. Maybe because I'm older and I'm female, the one thing I noticed about Alex in the way is that he's very sad. You know, he is sort of being pulled into the spy game a lot.
I think the secret of the success of the Alex Rider books, if there is one, is simply this, is that he's a reluctant spy. He just wants to be an ordinary kid. He wants to, you know, go to school, he wants to have friends, he wants to play computer games like any other teenager. And all the time he's being pulled out and thrown into these extraordinary adventures. And you say there's an element of sadness to him. He has no parents, of course, and that's part of it. But I think he is also quite isolated. And the worst thing for him is that the people who use him, MI6 in Britain or CIA in America, are by and large completely untrustworthy. I think that's very much part of the age we live in, unfortunately. Ever since the Iraq War, we have come to know that we cannot, unfortunately, trust the intelligence agencies. And that very much informed the books. But I have to say this, you know, that I think it's very important that the book should not be sad. The books are very upbeat, very optimistic, and Alex is somebody who is very much a positive thinker and who succeeds and is enabled through the books. These books are about empowerment.
It's one thing that I've noticed that, you know, and you do this, and of course it is very James Bond as well, the fact that Alex gets into all these incredibly impossible situations of impending doom, but the first thing he thinks of is, okay, how do I start getting myself out of this?
Alex Rider gets himself out of scrapes by using his ingenuity. Not gadgets necessarily, and not violence, and not things that are sort of far-fetched or silly. I mean, what is great about him as a character is that he can always think his way out of trouble, or talk his way out of trouble, or, you know, find clever ways of getting out of trouble. And that's part of the fun of it. I should say it's much easier getting him into the trouble than it is getting him out, but that's part of the challenge.
You actually, in a lot of your afterwards, thank the people who help you do your research, and let's see, you've had germ warfare, you've had genetic engineering, you've had cloning. You cover a lot of topics that I think are actually even somewhat, dare I say, educational. And you research this?
I take a great deal of care with the research for these books. One of the great pleasures of writing the book is for myself to go on a voyage of discovery and to discover all these bizarre things. For Crocodile Tears, I wanted to know how to blow up a dam. So you wouldn't have thought that a sort of a dam engineer would be the person to turn to, but sure enough, I met a wonderful man who worked for Scottish Power, who allowed me to fly up to Inverness and took me to a wonderful double curvature arch dam. And we spent the day there together walking around, and he was pointing out, oh, if you put your bomb in there, that would do terrible damage. I can see, and you know, we forget in this world that there are lots and lots of people out there who are willing to be helpful and kind just for the sake of it and who make no demands in return. And writing children's books is a thoroughly enjoyable experience, and meeting the people who help me is certainly a big part of that.
How do you balance the fact that, I mean, and the characters actually talk about in the books, the fact that, you know, he can do all these things because he's 14 and no one suspects him, but at the same time they're like, he is a kid, how can you let him do all this?
In Crocodile Tears, he's beginning to grow up. I mean, he's grown out of his bicycle, and when he goes back into MI6, the first thing that the head of MI6 says, and he says it in a very disapproving voice, is you're growing up, you're getting tall. And of course, the bigger he is, the less useful he is to the intelligence agencies. You know, Alex is an ordinary kid. Yes, he's got a few abilities like taekwondo, and he can walk on a tripwire, as it happens, not a trapeze wire. I mean, and he can do karate, but I don't think he's a superhero. He's quite an ordinary kid.
The one thing I was thinking is, my gosh, this kid has had one heck of a 14th year. I mean, when I was reading, realizing that every single book sort of started from the one before, it's just like, wow, that's 1 year.
I often say that, you know, Alex has saved the world 8 times in 1 year, and all he's got out of it is a bad school report, because he's never at school, poor kid. He's always having to do catch-up. And, you know, in a sense, it's strange credibility, and I have to work very hard to make sure that, you know, it doesn't become too ridiculous, the amount of action and the amount of adventures he's had. But I think it was the right decision even so. But, yes, it's absolutely true. It has been one very, very busy year.